Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, and this week we're diving headfirst into a horrific yet baffling crime, the murder of Mark Waugh. On October 12, 2013, the 23-year-old Georgetown law student met his friends, 24-year-old Raul Gupta and Gupta's 23-year-old girlfriend, Taylor Gould, for a night of partying to celebrate Raul's birthday. After having dinner and bar hopping until 2 a.m., the couple returned to their Silver Spring, Maryland high-rise studio apartment on the 16th floor, along with Mark Waugh. Surveillance footage of the trio entering the building shows no behavior indicative of the explosive violence that's about to transpire. But within an hour, Mark Waugh will be viciously stabbed to death, and in a situation where intoxication prevents Gould and Gupta from remembering what happened. No one can recall the brutal murder itself. Or so they say. What starts as the couple feigning ignorance soon turns to finger pointing, and by the end, we'll realize that no matter who's guilty, they were all hiding something, from the victim to the assailant to the conduit between them. So let's try to figure out what went down behind closed doors that fateful night. The main players in this night out are the three I've already mentioned, plus another friend named Josh. According to witnesses, there was somewhat of a disagreement between Josh and Taylor later in the evening as the drinks led to more drinks and everybody started to get a bit sloppy. Taylor was known for being flirtatious with Raul's friends, something he apparently didn't enjoy. On this night, however, while Josh claims Taylor was flirting with him, Taylor says the opposite is true, that she was not flirting with him and wanted him to stay away. It's difficult to say exactly what happened, especially given the amount of alcohol being consumed and the truth that Mark is no longer around to give his account of what he witnessed. What seems likely to me, given that both Taylor and Josh felt they were correct, is that Taylor was probably innocently flirting as she might normally, and Josh, given the alcohol involved, took it as an invitation instead of harmless flirting. Now, Mark gets involved in this as he places himself in the middle of the two parties, choosing to side with Taylor. Nothing significant seems to happen on that front, meaning there's not some climactic argument and nobody gets dragged out of the bar screaming by a bouncer. 2 a.m. rolls around, the bar is closing, and Josh simply goes home. That means, for all intents and purposes, this event is over. Sure, there could be lingering feelings or things that could be discussed. Maybe someone is even owed an apology. But whatever the case might be, if Josh went home and Taylor went home, both arriving safely, all's well that ends well. In terms of significance, this is just a normal night out drinking. Jealousy, blackouts, flirting, misunderstandings, these are all a normal part of the ugliness that can arise when young people start throwing down drinks. In this case, it seems as though cooler heads prevailed, which is usually how it goes, and Mark seemed to be at the forefront of that. So, people go home, sleep it off, and wake up hungover to realize what they've done, making a false assertion that they're never going to drink again. But that doesn't happen here. So, we have to garner an understanding of why. Let's examine the dynamics of this group of people. We have four people present. There certainly could have been other people there to celebrate, but for the purposes of this discussion, let's look at the main players. Mark, Raul, Taylor, Josh. What do we notice from the start? There is only one female present in this group. We know Raul is dating Taylor and lives with her. Of course, we have three men and Raul is taken. The other two guys, Mark and Josh, are heterosexual, but they aren't with women. They're alone. So, if we have two young heterosexual men who are not with women, it's reasonable to believe that they desire them. And if they go out with a friend who's a woman and likes to flirt, there's no need to break the ice with a complete stranger. This can lead to an unspoken agreement in which the men are permitted to be less courageous and, by extension, have chosen a path that doesn't lead to a place beyond harmless flirting. It's easy to get attention from your buddy's girlfriend, and there are reasons for that. But what we need to realize here, before analyzing any of this information extensively, is that there is already a recognizable pattern of behavior from start to finish. Of these three males, they will be dispatched, one by one, first through ostracism and then by violence, in order to crown the alpha. So, I want to relay a quick story about how these dynamics work and why we try to manipulate them to work in our favor. I specifically remember a night out drinking with friends at about that age and with those same dynamics. I was out with a friend and his girlfriend, along with two other male friends, drunk at a bar. I left the group to get a drink, and my friend's girlfriend did the same a minute later. We saw each other at the bar, and a conversation started. It turns out we had a lot in common, and she was really interested in talking to me about all sorts of interesting topics her boyfriend really couldn't accommodate. He was mostly a jock, and I love sports too, so I had that connection with him, but he didn't really have the same artistic interests as his girlfriend. And so, if you're not getting something at home, what often happens is that you go out looking for it. But that can be dangerous in situations like these, and for a specific reason. We normally choose friends who are very similar to us, but offer something we don't, or even can't. They have some type of quality we admire, and we wish we could be more like that. In return, your friends generally feel the same way. To them, you're someone who brings an element to the table that they don't possess. And so, as a collective unit, your friendships allow you the influence of things that would otherwise be missing from your life. So, when my friend sees me talking to his girlfriend, and it looks like there was something fishy going on, his eyes get wide, and I can see him having thoughts of the two of us going home together. Eventually, he approaches, makes some excuse for intervening, and sends his girlfriend off to buy another round so he can talk to me about what's going on. He goes on to say it looks like we're hitting on each other, and it's making him uncomfortable to see us flirt like that. And I said, "Look, man, you're about 6 inches taller than I am, and much better looking. You're putting this in the context of a threat, but what you need to do is step back and understand why she's doing it. People often go looking for what they can't get at home, and what she couldn't get at home was a sophisticated conversation from a guy who understood that she wanted that kind of attention. She wanted to be intellectually stimulated." I said, "Look, you have a choice. You can let a chicken roam in the broad confines of a fenced-in yard, allowing it the perception of greater freedom, even though it's still trapped, or you can literally put it in a small cage and force it to suffer greatly. The difference is that the first chicken, while still confined, will not feel imprisoned in the yard, so it will have borders and boundaries, but if you create a prison, people will want to get out, and that's the chicken in the cage. That's what controlling men force on their partners, creation of a prison." So my friend thought about that. He eased off. The jealousy subsided. He realized I was right. And a few months later, it was entirely apparent to him, by way of that incident, that these two weren't right for each other. He could have gotten angry with me. He could have become upset with his girlfriend. And all that would lead to is telling both of us to stay away from each other, or making a threat, or even keeping tabs on her at all times of the day. But he didn't. He did the mature thing. He thought, maybe she isn't right for me. Maybe I can't give her what she needs, even though I have a lot to offer. Maybe it's better to give these things to someone else so we can all be happy. So, basically, what I'm saying is, when you see a situation like that, meaning a girlfriend flirting with a friend, it's better to ask what it means rather than immediately wondering how you can put a stop to it or even thinking it needs to be stopped. Caging people who seek greater freedom isn't a solution. It's better to ask what the person needs and if the reason this is happening is because you can't provide that. More than anything, it's a courtesy to yourself. But it takes a confident, introspective person to accommodate that situation. I mean, we're designed to become emotional about these things. We feel the weight of deception, lies, betrayal, and all things similar. Sometimes our value, in our minds at least, is predicated upon the loyalty and worthiness others allow us. So, my friend was in a position to say, "You know what? You're correct. This is the wrong person for me. Instead of being angry, I should be looking for the right one." And he did that because he was a confident guy with the ability to make it happen. He had the resources to start over. But had his circumstances been different, he might have felt as though getting angry was his only option. he might have felt like letting go wasn't a possibility. What if he felt like he had to protect his pride? Okay, fine. But what would cause him to do that? If Taylor Gould was routinely flirting with Raoul's friends, he needed to ask why. What was she missing in her home life? Well, remember the analogy I just made about being imprisoned in a cage as compared to roaming in a yard with a fence? What Taylor is doing at the bar, meaning flirting with other guys, is the equivalent of roaming around the yard. She's staying within the confines of her relationship and following the rules, but she seems to have a reputation for flirting excessively. Each time she goes out, it seems, her flirtation is at least noticed, if not an issue that needs to be addressed. So, what we understand by default of her being so staunchly predisposed to this roaming, so to speak, is that she's overcompensating in her social life for something that's occurring elsewhere. And if the subject in question is flirting with other men by way of roaming in the yard, then the root of that which she's overcompensating for must be that her life feels like a prison in another context elsewhere. The yard with space to roam is what she desires, and if she's doing a lot of roaming but isn't trying to escape through a hole in the fence, we need to understand why she's adhering to this logic. If she's able to roam in the yard, she's also able to leave the farm and never come back. It says she should have free will. So, what is her prison from an emotional standpoint as well as physical? We must have a place that replicates the chicken's cage and also its incarceration due to circumstance. The answer to that question is the reason this crime happened. And strangely enough, this is one of those cases in which we need to know why it transpired even before we can understand what happened in terms of the unseen events. We have three young men and one young woman at the start of this odyssey. By the end, only one man will be left alive, covered in blood, and alone with his mate. This is exactly what it looks like. It's as primitive as it gets. By the end of the night, one of these men will be desperate to crown himself the alpha, and his lack of leverage in doing so at the time will cause him to stoop to physical violence as a last resort. That's how the world works. When someone or a group of people decides they cannot achieve supremacy in any other way but still demand it, violence erupts. It doesn't matter if it's a fight between two bears or revolution against a government. So, what is going on here that we should know about? Why is it so inherently dangerous to even consider going back to Taylor and Raoul's apartment that night? Well, Taylor is a recent college grad who has gone on to work with the FDA after completing her studies in biomedical engineering. She's a working career professional. Raoul, on the other hand, while he's equally ambitious in that field of biomedical engineering, is still in school. He's working toward completing his studies. All of which is to say, Raoul is broke. Taylor is helping him pay all his bills at home as he pays for his schooling. From a practical standpoint, there's nothing unusual about that. They're a young couple living together in a situation in which one person finishes school before the other. That's what people do sometimes. They help their partners so they can grow together. But here's the thing about that. Society has changed a great deal in recent history as it relates to women in the workforce. If you want to get an advanced degree in biomedical engineering in today's world and work for the FDA, you just go for it. There are no longer massive barriers in place to stop you from doing that. And the resistance that still unfairly remains in some professional areas, such as pay inequality and similar considerations, like maternity leave, will dwindle over time. Those are social considerations. But on an evolutionary level, it's an even uglier picture. Men are left to suffer the emotional fallout from women joining them as seekers, hunters, conquerors, etc., because evolution makes no adjustment to men's emotional disposition to compensate. Men are still designed by nature, by way of the brain, to feel as though they need to be the dominant partner, from physical strength to finances. It can't be reasoned out of our logic. It's a product of design. So one of the very few options men have, on a professional level, to stifle the reality of this change, is pay inequality. Women generally view pay inequality as something enforced by men to shortchange their perceived value, and that's correct. But pay inequality is nothing more than a desperate attempt by men to compensate for the fact society has made women viable hunters, thereby reducing or even negating the need for a man to be the dominant partner in a relationship. Essentially, men are less important to a woman's survival, and thereby success, than we ever have been. And since we don't have a way to change our nature in evolution and are forced to deal with it in society, we enforce social policies that dictate women will not only suffer the wrath of pay inequality, but also pay more for anything and everything considered female. Men have indulged a conspiracy that involves keeping their levels of pay higher than women and also forcing ladies to pay more for goods geared toward them. It's disgusting, but it's a product of perceived inadequacy, something men hate. Men have conceded a great deal on a social level, but as long as our nature, aka the construction of our brains, or evolution remains the same, which it will, we will not change to accommodate. If you follow that problem down to its root, what you understand is that humanity will need to make physical changes to our species to change our nature. Allowing women true equality in society is somewhat unrealistic without making physical changes to men, specifically our nature. Until we do that, just like you see with the issues now, from sexism to racism, the things that can't be changed socially will get buried in lies that amount to conspiracy. True racial and gender equality is earned by way of not having physical and emotional differences afforded by nature. As it stands, we must lie. Racism, over the years, has predominantly gone underground. It's more implicit and systemic in nature. Most racist people these days aren't calling out racial slurs in public like you might have seen back in the day. Sure, it still happens, but it's extreme today. And again, those are the extremists for the most part. You can't do that today without making a fool of yourself. Social change prevents it. But beneath the niceties of social change, we understand implicit racism runs rampant in today's world. You can still deny someone a job, a friendship, or anything else under the guise of a different reason. The same thing goes for sexism. If a pregnant woman shows up at a job interview, and that's why you aren't going to hire her, you can just choose from a multitude of false reasons as justification of why you didn't give her the job. And all of this conflict boils down to the fact that true equality isn't possible within the framework of today's world. Men are still designed, by nature, to dominate, while women have evolved through society to become our equals. It creates conflict. Again, notice how evolution sets itself up to win by way of conflict. The only way out of this predicament entirely, from racism to sexism, is to employ physical change along with emotional change. Emotional change is the province of society. We dream of a better world and make a plan for getting there by doing things differently in terms of our behavior. But evolution has specifically created that dilemma because it allows only one solution in the end, which is physical change. Specifically, creation of technology. Emotional change always precedes physical change. Always. If you feel like you need to mature, it hits you emotionally. You feel shame, and then you take action. Our collective change as a species happens that way as well. First, we undergo emotional change, aka acknowledging and addressing the fact social injustice exists, such as racism or sexism, and making the emotional changes we can to accommodate. But just like all of our other problems, once we've taken action emotionally, we must do so physically to complete the process. First, you dream it. Then you build it. So, we want equality and have dreamed of a world like that, which has led to emotional changes that start to affect our behavior. But as we do not have the technology to fully compensate, meaning we can't make sufficient artificial beings today to transcend those issues physically, an implicit conspiracy against the suffering parties or groups continues into perpetuity. It must be hidden as a survival mechanism. Evolution doesn't want us to know the answer is AI, for fear we'd indulge the physical changes before having adequate technology. So at the core of the sexism angle, it's apparent the conspiracy men are employing in today's world is a product of insecurity, inadequacy, and related concerns. We're still designed to dominate, but our physical strength, along with our world history of being the breadwinners, is deteriorating out of necessity. In the absence of a solution related to physical change, we must indulge conspiracy. So what that means is that men will find it very difficult, if not impossible, to avoid strong feelings of inadequacy or lack of dominance unless they can find a traditional relationship where they're the breadwinner, as their brains are still designed to desire such a thing, to feel as though their purpose has been fulfilled. On a functional level, there are plenty of successful relationships that defy this ideal, but I would seriously doubt any of them contain a man who doesn't harbor feelings of insecurity and inadequacy in the process. We're more open-minded to alternative relationships today because we've evolved emotionally, but a man's intellect is still going to implore him to be a hunter and be dominant. It's his nature. That means we literally have to fix nature in order to solve this problem. In the meantime, however, what we see in this case is that Rahul Gupta is in that spot. His girlfriend is the breadwinner. She supports him as he's finishing his studies. And at the base of that idea, without further investigation, we see one thing. Lack of control. That's the foundation of the issue. It makes men feel out of control. So the end result of that emotional value will be something that mirrors it with a physical value, aka a man going out of control. That's what happens here. So now, put the incidents to follow into the context of feeling out of control. The incident at the bar with Josh and Taylor, out in public and having a good time, is the equivalent of it happening out in the yard where the chickens roam free. To avoid a nightmarish ending, all that needs to happen is for Josh to keep his space and go home at the end of the night. There are escape valves equating to freedom. No one is stuck at the bar. They don't live there. But back at the studio, or the cage, things are a bit more congested and intimate. This apartment is 500 square feet. With furniture in it, there isn't much room to breathe. And that's been the case here emotionally as well. Rahul and Taylor haven't exactly been living a dream in recent months. They've been arguing a lot. It once seemed like they had a future together, hence the living and financial arrangement, but now that's come into question. What we can say for sure is they feel stuck. Rahul relies on Taylor's income to survive, and Taylor feels obligated to help since this arrangement is keeping Rahul afloat while he finishes school. She's dominant. And we could probably speculate with some degree of accuracy that Rahul had trouble dealing with that over the long term as they lived together. It probably seemed okay in theory, but in practice I'm guessing it caused friction between them. There have been allegations Rahul was abusive in a previous relationship and has a known dark side, while other speculation suggests the divide between the two was Taylor's flirting issue itself. It's probably safe to say, however, that the flirting was a byproduct of something else. It was attention she wasn't getting. And so, we have to ask ourselves why Taylor decided to bring Mark home with them the night of the murder. It wouldn't be too practical to plan to hook up with some other guy. She says it's because Mark was helping her to deal with Josh. But that's a ridiculous answer. Josh left the bar and went home. He didn't follow them. If they see each other again, in the future, there might be an issue, but it's over for the night. So why does Mark need to come back to this small studio to hang out at 2 a.m.? If I'm asking that question, you better believe Rahul is wondering the same. And this is why it's so important. It's a double whammy for him. Mark isn't just some dude. Mark is Raul's close friend, and Taylor is his girlfriend. If they seem to form some sort of bond or allegiance, that could easily have Rahul believing Mark has supplanted him as the man in her romantic relationship. It doesn't have to be true. He just has to perceive a shift. We have to consider they're blackout drunk. So let's document that shift now. Josh seems to be putting the moves on Taylor, but notice in all of the chaos that ensues, no one talks about Raoul reacting poorly, or even at all. He obviously didn't say anything to Josh when he was flirting, and then also said nothing when Mark started talking to his girlfriend. He didn't even object to another guy coming home with them. So I think what we can see is that Raoul's dark side is a domestic thing. He doesn't assert himself. He just waits until he needs to explode and does it at home, which is undoubtedly the reason this living space started to feel like a prison. That's where he unloaded. That's his deal. Unfortunately for Mark Waugh, he's about to get caught in something we often refer to as a love triangle, because normally nobody gets killed. But in the primal depths of our being, in our unconscious minds, we still have that inclination toward physical violence as a means of domination when all else fails, just like in the wild. Every alpha predator prefers to do nothing to maintain respect, simply for the fact that it requires the fewest calories and allows for minimizing risk. They only act decisively when necessary. So Raoul Gupta will follow that blueprint, and it becomes deadly because, unlike his normal explosions with Taylor in which he can simply impose his will to dominate, Mark is actually a larger male predator. Raoul is a bit thicker than Mark, but Mark is significantly taller. He's a threat, and Taylor is bringing him home for a reason. Again, her flirting is done to meet her needs. She's trying to get something she doesn't get at home. Except this time, the fatal mistake is that, instead of keeping the flirting out in the yard, she brings it home to the cage. And there's not enough room for two alpha predators in here. Because Raoul, as we know, explodes in this place. Notice that Taylor, innocently flirting with Josh earlier in the night, leads him to project it might be more than that, and he goes overboard in a way that she feels like he's taking advantage of her. So she's turned off by that, and wishes someone could just understand what she wants. Raoul obviously doesn't. He doesn't even intervene in the incident. But Mark does. He's the voice of reason. By extension of that, Taylor allows him to be the next subject of her innocent flirting, and he continues to be reasonable. He keeps Josh at bay and acts like a gentleman, but with all due respect to the victim, who obviously suffered the ultimate price in this case, it's not difficult to see by his bad choice to return to the studio later that night that perhaps, in his own projections, there was a chance with Taylor. And, you know, maybe something was already going on. And even if not, men in particular are designed to be unrealistic in terms of potential love interests because it forces them to try to mate with the most desired women, ensuring nature's requirement for the most competition in places with the best perceived genetics. The world is full of creeps, even the good guys, but that's nature's fault. Anyway, all Taylor really wants by bringing Mark home with them is to experience what it's like to have someone like him at home with her. Her emotional wound is that Raoul is at best highly argumentative and at worst abusive, so the way that's going to manifest for her, in the same way as the flirting outside the home, is to temporarily replace Raoul with someone who exhibits the positive characteristics she can't get from him at home. That's what she wants to feel. When they're at the bar, Mark stands up for her. Raoul doesn't. Mark is the voice of reason. Raoul is synonymous with arguments. Mark listens to Taylor. Raoul is apathetic. He just seems to let her flirt, and then she pays a price later when they're alone at home. He blows up on her. Except this time, they won't be alone. And if it's going to go down, and Mark is going to defend her in any way, he'll have to be dominated as well. Because as soon as an argument begins, if Mark takes Taylor's side, which is likely to happen because the reason he ended up back there is because of their allegiance against Josh, Raul will then be the beta. He'll be in his own home with a larger guy standing up for his girlfriend, and in that position, he knows he isn't going to win a fair fight. It's not like it was just arguing with a woman. Now he's being brushed off by a competitor, and he doesn't like it. So in Raul's mind, there is only one way left to handle this issue. He has to kill Mark. That's the decisive action. He wants to manipulate being an alpha to compensate not only for the inadequacy he felt in relation to his living arrangement with Taylor supporting him, but also for the inadequacy of not feeling like he could defeat Mark in a fair fight. Raul didn't normally object to the flirting until they got home and he exploded. In this instance, he did the same thing, but Mark became an obstacle he couldn't overcome in the absence of violence. If this happened sober, a fist fight is probably the worst thing that would have happened. But Raul was wasted. So was Taylor. We assume Mark was in a similar condition. This situation was dynamite. And it's obvious to us, so just imagine how apparent it was to them. Clearly, there's a lot going on behind the words and actions that took place that night. People were following their desires, and perhaps not their good sense. I think Taylor wanted to know what it felt like to have a reasonable, chivalrous, and attentive man in her home because she was desperately missing that with Raul. It seems to me, at least on a subconscious level, given the behavior of all parties leading up to them entering the apartment, that nobody wanted to stop a train from going off the rails because they all had something to prove that night. I think Taylor wanted her relationship with Raul to come apart at the seams rather than deteriorate over long, dreadful months in that small apartment. I think Mark was interested in Taylor, and being a bright guy, probably understood, whether explicitly or intuitively, that she and Raul were on the verge of ending. These are all normal desires and reactions, regardless of morality. But here's where the problem arises. Raul's desire is to prove himself the alpha. He knows that if Taylor's perspective shifts to Mark as the alpha, there's no way for him to change that under the rules of the social contract. But if he regresses, even momentarily, just in his mind, to a primal place where society doesn't exist, he has an option for winning. Violence. Violence leading to death. Otherwise, he's the beta, even in his own home. So, if an argument breaks out at home, like it normally does after Taylor flirts, and Mark is there, we also see the manifestation of Taylor's desires in all of this mess. She wants someone to stand up to Raul because she's afraid, and for good reason. If this didn't happen, it's very likely Taylor could have become Raul's victim instead. It gives us some insight not only into what Taylor might have been experiencing while living with Raul, but also suggests, again, at least on a subconscious level, she's engaging in active self-sabotage on her relationship, and Mark is game to play. But what's really scary is that all of these people are very bright. They all know what's going on here. Raul sees it, and he's letting it happen. He'll explode later. As soon as he gets home. And he does. Like he wanted. It's self-sabotage. Just like Taylor's plight. And the same goes for Mark. He sacrificed himself for that risk. No one should ever be killed for something so petty, of course. But I do believe each of these individuals allowed their desires to manifest in a way that guaranteed tragedy. The result was about as bad as it gets. We know Raul isn't going to kill Taylor because the whole point was to dominate. He wanted to be the alpha male. She hasn't created an explicit breakup situation in which he is forced to dominate by violence against her because of his separation leaving him out of control. in Raoul's mind, since his emotional problem has manifested onto a physical canvas for lack of another available solution, once he kills Mark, he assumes the role of the Alpha again. This is an incredibly tragic circumstance. In terms of explicit motivation, I don't think anyone involved envisioned this incident ending how it did. It's a nightmare. Raoul gets 25 years in prison, and Taylor is haunted forever. But we still don't know exactly what transpired within the apartment. As the three enter the building, they're seen on security cameras. Everybody seems to be in a good mood. There's no obvious sign of tension or arguing. The same goes for when they get on the elevator shortly thereafter. Everybody is seen smiling and joking around. Mark enters the elevator doing this really strange motion that's almost a cross between holding out his arms to make air lats and walking like an ape. I had to look at this a few times to understand what it meant. Mark does this because he steps in front of Raoul onto the elevator, and before getting on, he'd been talking with Taylor face to face. Both Raoul and Mark intuitively know what the other is thinking, and Mark feels pressure to defer to Raoul in some type of way that makes him look like a joke in the role of the Alpha. So he steps onto the elevator waddling with his legs and arms out like a more primitive primate to symbolically suggest his dominance is a joke, and he's not a threat, easing tension as they get into what is a very small space on the elevator. This is actually a very common archetype, meaning the Joker. In movies, plays, and all other forms of media, the leading roles often have friends who serve as comic relief and are therefore not a threat to dominate the story by limiting themselves to being that. Mark is doing a drunk version of that here. Goofy equals harmless. The Joker is intended to avoid a conflict of romantic involvement with a female lead. They're not supposed to have a romantic narrative, so in many movies, you'll often see at least a reference or joke made about the Joker friend of the female lead and Joker friend of the male lead getting together. And whether she rejects him or accepts him, the response is designed to be funny because it's their purpose. Throughout time, the Joker has provided comic relief for couples, but the Joker has his place and knows it. It's dangerous to say you're the Joker, like the third wheel, but have ulterior motives. And Raoul sees that. He isn't stupid. Mark is using a very common technique employed in the wild, which is camouflaging himself to seem as though he's something he's not, in order to survive the situation. Unfortunately, this manipulation is not in the vein of survival in terms of life and death, but his chances with Taylor Gould, which makes him a predator lurking and not innocent prey. The camouflage has intention beyond preservation. It gets him close, into the cave. That's where Taylor sleeps. But so does Raoul. And since Mark is employing these archetypes, including the shapeshifter, Raoul's intuitive understanding will be primal. Now, tragically, Raoul is doing the same thing to Mark. He's playing the game. He's acting as well, but feigning ignorance. And so is Taylor. They want this. I can guarantee they didn't want it to end how it did, but the narrative of three friends innocently going back to their apartment before a murder suddenly occurred without any warning is false. The mechanics of what happened that night are not lost on any of them. They've created a situation in which there will be a climactic event, but never in their worst projections of what might happen did they consider murder. Either way, this freight train rolls right down the tracks, and soon enough, Mark Waugh will be dead. It seems obvious Raoul killed him. Now, an interesting thing to note is the behavior of certain primates in the wild. Chimps are a great example. Alpha male chimpanzees are generally divided into two categories, one being alphas who are strictly bullies, and the other being those who are like them, but also possess leadership qualities such as breaking up fights and maintaining general order. The former doesn't last long at the top because their rigid behavior ultimately brings about circumstances that can see them ousted from the group, unseated from power, or even killed. The latter type, though, serves as the voice of reason and the threat of muscle, so they remain leaders for a longer period. Raoul was the bully, and the bully alone. Mark proved himself an alpha in Taylor's eyes by standing up to Josh for her and maintaining peace in the group with reason. It was those leadership qualities that distinguished him from Raoul. Raoul was not a leader to Taylor. She was paying his bills and suffering his cold nature. He and Taylor weren't communicating properly, and along comes Mark Waugh. Now, again, we don't know what went on behind closed doors. Taylor's intoxication is obvious in the 911 call. She barely has a clue what's going on. And that leads me to believe there is a possibility she got drunk enough that she might have kissed Mark while Raoul went to the kitchen to get a drink or something like that. If he saw it upon his return, he might have grabbed a knife while enraged. We'll likely never know if it was brief physical contact between these two that precipitated this, or if the trigger incident was actually an argument leading to that. But we can say for sure, Raoul was unseated as the alpha, even if just by way of his perception, either through a physical act, such as Taylor and Mark kissing, or an emotional one, meaning Mark taking her side and being the voice of reason in a heated argument, leaving Raoul on his own. Both things could have happened, painting a full emotional and physical portrait of domination Raoul simply could not accept. That shift had to occur, one way or another. That's what made Raoul Gupta snap. Mark Waugh had become King of the Hill, even if just for a single moment, and Raoul Gupta desperately knocked him down. But of course, it was a false crown, and his emotional prison became a physical one, as often happens in tragedy. It manifests in the same way as the emotional issue leading to the physical act of murder. So, with everybody so drunk and one person dead, it's difficult to ascertain the truth. Either way, we understand the dynamic dictated nothing positive would happen. Yet, just as we're convinced Raoul was the killer, and that we know what happened, everything changes. Taylor Gould is about to make one of the strangest 911 calls you can imagine, and then she'll follow that up with statements to police that cast serious doubt upon her innocence. So let's comb through part of the 911 call. Here's the audio.
What do you need the police for?
My friend is, he's here, and I need emergency right now.
Okay, what is going on that you need the police? What is happening?
I don't know.
Okay, we need to know what assistance you need.
Raoul, what
is happening
what is
with your friend?
I'm he's not breathing, okay? I don't know.
Taylor, hello. Can somebody come back to the phone, please? Hello?
Stop!
Hello, Taylor? Has anyone been drinking or using any drugs tonight?
Yeah.
Okay, who has? Everybody?
Yeah.
What have you been drinking?
Just alcohol.
Okay, what kind of alcohol has everybody been drinking?
Just alcohol. I don't know.
I'm just
I need someone
because,
here tonight right now.
Ma'am, they're coming right now, but the way that you've been answering questions, something's not right. You need to tell me what is happening.
I don't know. I just need someone here. There's blood
okay,
everywhere.
What do you mean there's blood everywhere? What happened?
I don't know.
How do you not know? You see what's going on. We don't. You need to tell us and paint the picture of what's happening right now.
I don't know. I just see someone here. I'm scared. I just want someone here.
Okay, so it's not too difficult to identify the particular theme Taylor is using to modify the events. We have a great deal of omission here. Now, what she's doing, without question, is a clear sign of guilt, but we certainly can't say that guilt is in relation to her being the perpetrator who inflicted the fatal blows upon Mark Waugh. What we can say for sure is that she's hiding something. This is a fairly common practice for people calling 911 in the context of guilt. Michael Peterson, again, is a great example. He desperately wanted an ambulance, but was equally desirous of not elaborating upon what the actual problem was that he called about. The dispatcher kept pressing him for more information, and Michael literally just hung up the phone. Same thing for Patsy Ramsey. And it's really this simple. You don't want to say anything on a 911 call to potentially incriminate yourself. So you refrain from defining an event in a way that truly clarifies exactly what happened. You just keep giving bits of info until the 911 operator finally has enough to send help. And then you do whatever you can to feign ignorance by way of confusion. In Taylor's case here, it's obvious she's intoxicated, but equally as apparent, she's hiding something by way of omission. So she exhibits incoherence in terms of her being really drunk, and the police speculated her level of intoxication was the greatest of the group. But her delivery of the vital information excludes two pertinent ideas. One is that Mark Waugh is dead. She knows that. The other is that he was murdered. Yet, Taylor only wants to tell us there's blood everywhere. But I think we all know that when you call 911 because someone just got butchered in your studio apartment, the primary point of discussion should be that person who was lying dead on the floor. Of course, it's possible she didn't know he was dead yet, or maybe he was actually still breathing. But either way, if she can see the blood everywhere, and this is a one-room apartment, aside from the bathroom, the killing would not only happen directly in front of her, but the body would be in plain sight as well. So we have to consider two avenues for Taylor's response. One consideration is that she feels guilty for whatever her participation might have been, even if it was just instigating a showdown by way of her flirting. The other, of course, is that someone did this vicious stabbing, and like I said, if it was Raoul, and she rats him out right at that moment, she could easily be next. So I think Taylor has to play this one on the fence, giving her the dilemma of desperately trying to satisfy Raoul and the 911 operator simultaneously. What she wants is for the police to show up without prior knowledge, hoping they'll ascertain a different conclusion than the ugly truth that's being requested by the 911 operator. Michael Peterson did it. Patsy Ramsey did it. You find a way to get them to show up, but stonewall preliminary investigative techniques by refusing to commit to any type of official narrative. You do that when the true narrative will be costly to your freedom or the well-being of someone else who's involved. Peterson wanted them to just show up in hopes they conclude his wife fell down the stairs. Patsy wanted the police to just show up, hoping they would conclude JonBenet had been kidnapped. In this case, Taylor is protecting Raoul, partially out of fear, and otherwise due to her guilt. So, she tells 911 her friend isn't breathing, and she doesn't know what happened, which is perfectly understandable because the huge, sharp, bloody kitchen knife with the male body next to it wouldn't have been a sufficient clue to figure it out. And 911 operators will press you in these situations, even to the point of hostility, because they have a responsibility to provide first responders, both police and medical, what they believe is an accurate representation of what's transpiring. If there's still a maniac with a knife roaming around, he needs to be detained or even eliminated to allow a situation in which medical personnel can do their jobs. Lying to the 911 operator like this puts other people's lives in danger and slows the response time. Meanwhile, Raoul is in the background, yelling about where the fucking police are, and one thing clearly emanates from his voice. Anger. He's pressuring Taylor, as though this process should be well underway already. Now, Taylor is in a place at this point where she can't satisfy both the 911 operator and Raoul. So, what does she do in this dilemma? In the same way Michael Peterson chooses to hang up at this juncture and Patsy Ramsey also ends the call. Taylor will remain on the line, but leaves the conversation to go argue with Raul, thwarting the 911 dispatcher's advances. She knows she can't go any further without saying what happened. We know her friend isn't breathing. There's blood everywhere. The only thing left to say is that he got stabbed to death. That's why she steps away. But she'll come back to the call, and you better believe 911 is going to press her. This time, the dispatcher explicitly tells Taylor she knows something isn't right by the way she's offering information. She leans on Taylor to tell her what happened. Taylor responds, quote, "I just need someone here. There's blood everywhere," end quote. Now, just is an interesting word. The use of the word just can be entirely innocent, but its creation was actually intended for the purpose of manipulating people. When you add the word just to modify any sentence in relation to desire, you're specifically narrowing the focus of the word to one idea that acts as a roadblock along the way to an uncomfortable truth that you want to hide. Let's say you recently hurt someone emotionally in a relationship, and it led to a breakup, but you wanted to get back with that person, back to how things were. You know you hurt someone. You can't demand to have that person back. So the idea is to ease your way back into the picture, slowly but surely. You wouldn't pick up your phone and text, "We need to get back together today because I'm suffering without you." That would sound desperate and crazy. You might just text to say hi. The person might say they're surprised to hear from you after what happened. They wonder if it's a good idea to have contact again. And you say something like, "I just want to talk." You don't say, "I want to get back together right now." So the idea with the word just is to afford the recipient the narrowest version of your truth as possible to protect the things that exist in the subtext from becoming explicitly apparent. We veil the truth, so to speak, by only offering as much as they need to succeed. So Taylor says, "I just need someone here." She refuses to go beyond scratching the surface of necessity, precluding her desire as singular with the use of the word just, as though a cop showing up is the only consideration that's important here. And of course, that's true if you just killed someone and are covering for the victim's killer. When pressed again, she says, "I'm just scared and I want someone here." Notice the use of the word just again, narrowing her reasoning down to her being scared, when the reality is that the police need to come because somebody just got murdered and he's dead on the floor. So, anyway, she gets her wish. The cops arrive and bring Taylor out into the hallway with them while they examine the studio's interior. Mark is dead on the floor. There's blood on the walls, floor, furniture, and especially all over Raul's clothes. He has blood on his face, and it's clear he was involved in a physical struggle with someone. So the police notice that both Taylor and Raul are very drunk. We see multiple booze bottles on the coffee table and a tall glass bong Raul used to smoke weed before going out that night. One of the cops asks Raul what happened, and he says, quote, "I caught my buddy and my girl cheating. I killed my buddy," end quote. It's a shocking revelation, but the problem with this confession is that Raul was very drunk. He's babbling and making very little sense otherwise. But what police can see is the difference in Taylor's appearance as opposed to Raoul's. Taylor has blood all over her lower legs, but very little, if any, on her upper body, and she's wearing a white t-shirt. She concedes having interacted with the body, but doesn't remember anything else. Raoul, on the other hand, has blood on his face, and it's also all over his shirt, in the area of his upper torso. With Raul seeming as though he's been in a fight, but Taylor appearing as though she probably just knelt next to the body afterward to check on Mark, Raul seems to be the perpetrator, yet nobody can remember what happened. So Taylor and Raul are both suspects and are taken in to do interviews with the police. Raul's confession was mired in so many odd drunk ramblings that they're not even sure he has any clue what happened. Taylor sits down with a detective, and this lady gets right to the point. She asks, "Did you kill Mark?" And Raul's gone now. Taylor is safe. She doesn't have to be afraid of retribution. But when asked point blank if she was the killer, Taylor says, "I don't know." And you can see her confusion. You can see the hangover setting in. She has one hand pressed to her temple, like she has a throbbing headache. And when presented with the possibility Raoul killed Mark because Taylor cheated with him, Taylor flat out denies it. She says she and Mark did nothing of the sort. But they're starting to sober at this point. It's been several hours, and now Raoul is claiming he just found Mark dead like that. He isn't confessing anymore. Yet the detective is going to back him into a corner, and while he doesn't break, he forces himself into a lie he can't avoid. The detective suggests if he can't really remember the murder, like he claims, then there's the possibility he did it, right? Raoul concedes that possibility exists, but he says he knows for a fact he didn't do it. Of course, that's ridiculous, because if you know for a fact, it's an assertion you'd recall. But Raoul doesn't remember, so how does he know for a fact? He couldn't. And that's the point. So he can see the police are dialed in on him. He's desperate. There's only one thing left to do. Blame Taylor. Now, Mark Waugh suffered a total of 11 stab wounds, several of which were defensive in nature. But of the fatal blows to his torso, one of them penetrated 7 inches deep. 7 inches. Try to picture Taylor Gould, who is much smaller than Mark, unloading on him with so much upper body strength that, even while defending himself, she managed to stick a knife 7 inches deep into him without getting blood on her shirt or even getting punched in the face, thrown off, scratched, or suffering any other type of defensive wounds. And of course, the better question is, why would she be so angry? Taylor had no reason to be angry at Mark. None. Raoul had every reason to be. And so, the way he eases into shifting the blame to Taylor is to start like this. Quote, "Him and Tay just made it seem like they had a thing going on, and as soon as I found that out, I just started doing my own thing." So, he makes it seem as though he separated himself from the pack, but what this really says is that Mark and Taylor sort of shut him out. He felt like a third wheel in his own home, which again, Taylor paid for, and in this situation, he was reduced to being the beta male. He tells us he nodded off on the couch from being drunk and stoned, and only woke up once he heard screaming, at which point he hurried to Mark and tried to stop the bleeding. He says he pulled Mark close, hugging him, as though he cared, which we have to assume is the way he's trying to justify the blood on his shirt. To be blunt, Raoul looks like he killed somebody. Taylor looks like the person who attended him in the aftermath. Raoul wants us to believe the roles were reversed. And by default of that logic, if he was asleep when Mark was killed, and nobody else was in the apartment, then he's suggesting a scenario in which only his girlfriend could be the killer. But we soon learn Mark texted a friend that night from the bathroom. I think the vague context suggests the tension was building. He wrote, quote, "My night is becoming historically awkward," end quote. And then, quote, "I'm about to gnaw my hand off so I can leave in the ambulance," end quote. So, something was brewing. And you'd have to wonder why Mark didn't leave with that being the case. He stays. I can only think Taylor was the reason he stayed, and that Raoul saw it. So he freaked out, whether it was a kiss, just an argument, or even the possibility that he passed out momentarily, woke up in a haze, and due to being paranoid about those two getting close all night, believed something transpired that actually didn't. There was a lot of alcohol involved. Their memories are better than they let on after the fact, but their behavior, from the 911 call to the actions and words police observed when responding, clearly showed they were blackout drunk at the time this incident took place. Their memories aren't exactly reliable. But now, watch Raoul complete the three-act structure of the narrative he tried to form to avail himself of the guilty confession he made to police when drunk. First, he said he didn't know if he did it. Then he said he knows for a fact it wasn't him, insinuating Taylor did it. He just needs to turn on her completely now. Check out this exchange. It says a lot about where the couple's relationship stood. Detective: What the heck happened? Raoul: Somebody got stabbed. Detective: Right. Raoul: So, again, I don't know. I didn't do it. Detective: If you didn't stab him, then who did? Tay? Raoul: Yeah. That pretty much tells us the relationship is heading down the drain. He sells her out in favor of himself, and it's a lie. Meanwhile, she never tries to blame him. He was the angry one, the vengeful one. We actually learn Taylor didn't even get the blood on her hands from touching Mark. In the background of the 911 call, we can hear Gupta, who's covered in blood, yelling for her to stop touching him. So, she has blood on her hands and feet, but not in relation to an attack. There's no blood on her face or hair, and her makeup is obviously still on her face, while the hair is dry, so she didn't try to wash it off or anything like that. This looks bad for Gupta. And we get this great moment of truth now from Taylor because, up until this point, she's been trying to play a political game with the detective in which she refuses to implicate herself or Raoul. The detective says Raoul named her the killer, and Taylor is shocked. She lets out a big fat OMG. She can't believe it. Up until now, she's pretended to be open to the possibility she did it, because it allowed the evidence to prove she didn't, while also allowing her the comfort of not having to rat out her boyfriend. But if she really believed that she didn't know if she stabbed Mark, then why would she be shocked when Raoul implicated her? The answer is that he betrayed the pact of not blaming the other person. They were both playing dumb and saying they didn't know what actually happened. When it became apparent to Raoul that detectives thought he was guilty, he turned. Raoul's lawyers suggest he was actually covering for Taylor because he was drunk, but once he began to sober, he realized he was going to go to prison for doing it. But speaking of sobering up, and from a more realistic standpoint, Raoul's attorneys point out that he can be heard in the background of the 911 call, helping Mark, saying, "Breathe, breathe," and conducting CPR on the victim. He's yelling for Taylor to call 911. And for them, that proves Raoul had no hatred toward Mark. But what it says to me is that he was likely blackout drunk, in a blind rage, and either waking up from passing out or on the verge of passing out when the attack took place. The adrenaline produced by the act of murder in a confrontation with Mark would leave him with sort of a second wind, so to speak, with increased awareness. This even happens during incidents that are far less traumatic. I mean, for anyone who drank at a party when they were underage, you know you can go from being really drunk to feeling sober pretty fast when the cops come knocking. You need clarity to handle these situations. Your body does its best to afford it. So Raoul seems like a dead duck at this point. Detectives have him in their sights. But that's when we learn Taylor Gould changed her clothes after the murder. Not once, but twice. And there's blood on the red dress she wore out that night, which is what she would have been wearing when the attack took place, we assume. And then there are marks on her hand. It appears as though she could have wielded the knife that night. At the base of Taylor's right hand, on the knuckle, we find a bright red mark indicative of recent, although mild, trauma. It looks like it got banged on something, or even suffered a light abrasion. She has pale skin, so it probably wouldn't take too much to produce this effect, but the placement of the mark is what you would expect to find after someone was stabbing another person, causing their hand to slide down the handle and hit the object they're stabbing or even a blade guard. But it's not enough. There has to be more to move on Taylor. That's when the police reveal that Taylor's fingernails were bloody and one of them was broken. Could she have been in a fight? It certainly seems that way with these details emerging. And that's when they find a contact lens stuck to the back of Mark Wall's jeans. It belongs to Taylor. They also discover long blonde hair stuck to the murder weapon, consistent with Taylor's hair, in addition to finding her hair stuck in a blood stain on a wall nearby. But the following really raised suspicion. That same long blonde hair was found in Mark Wall's hand. This is interesting, and detectives are confused. But at this point, after about 5 hours of questioning, they realize a coherent narrative isn't going to form. So they take an unusual chance on a technique rarely employed, but one they think might be effective. They put Raoul and Taylor together in an interview room and watch the conversation elsewhere. So Raoul keeps asking Taylor if she did it, and she can't give him a better answer than what amounts to her saying, "I don't think I did, but I don't remember." It's hard to tell if Raoul is just trying to get her to falsely admit it by pressuring her, or if these two have some unspoken pact in which they're not going to blame the other person, no matter what. The whole time, Taylor concedes she could be guilty because she doesn't remember. She seems remorseful about this event, whether she killed Mark or not. She's not running from anything. Raoul, on the other hand, hasn't once expressed his remorse for his close friend who got stabbed to death. The best he can say is, "I want to poop. I want to eat. I'm hungry. Get out there and tell him I want my lawyer and I want to get the fuck out of here. I just need to get the fuck out of here, dude." So, shortly after that meeting, detectives had seen enough. The truth was elusive. That much they knew for sure in this case. But as for everything else, this is what the lead detective stated. Quote, "I don't know that we believed either of them. But at the end of the day, there was more evidence to support his being responsible for the murder than her." End quote. And I agree. Raoul had motive, means, opportunity. It doesn't preclude Taylor as the killer, but she had no motive, no history of a bad temper, and no predisposition toward violence. Beyond that, Mark was a law student and a member of the debate team in both high school and college. It's extremely difficult to picture him and Taylor finding reason to do battle to the death. But when you put Raoul in that role, with the knife in his hand, that's a traditional love triangle scenario. It often plays out like that. It's a misguided battle between two males in a tight space for the perceived right to a female. In comparison to men, women rarely stoop to this kind of violence to prove a point. Mark proved himself the voice of reason earlier in the night. If he and Taylor had some type of altercation, we'd have to believe she was so enraged that, unlike earlier, he wasn't able to calm her worries in any way. Even if he put a move on her or something like that, I just don't buy it. This killing is the work of a guy. It's explosive rage. Raoul fits the profile, and the physical imprint left upon the scene points at him. He was obviously very drunk when the police arrived at the apartment, but rather than inhibiting his understanding of the truth, I think the booze allowed him to speak it. He knew they were going to see what happened, and just confessed. It wasn't until he realized the truth wasn't apparent to the police during questioning that he changed his tune, swinging the pendulum from confessed guilt all the way over to the other side of the spectrum with blaming Taylor. That's the key for me. Raoul did a 180. Taylor never budged. It became clear he had something to hide. But in court is where we learn what I suggested earlier actually happened, according to Raoul. Upon arriving home at 1601, Raoul, who kept his mouth shut all night, testified that he started an argument with Taylor about her flirting with Josh at the bar. He says after that happened, he was so wasted he fell and hit his head, and when he awoke, the incident had already taken place. That's when he gave Mark CPR. What we can see likely happened is that Raul started the argument, and with Mark already being a threat as another male with whom Taylor was flirting, he took extreme offense to Mark taking Taylor's side, or seeming to, as their guest tried to be the reasonable law student and debate team member he's known for being. In some way or another, Mark intervened and attempted to use reason. When Raul saw Mark and Taylor as a team working against him at that point, and without emotional recourse for solving the problem, he indulged physicality. Raul Gupta was not going to accept being the beta male. He had pride. He wanted control. All of the mounting insecurities and inadequacy boiled over. It cost him everything. In the wilderness, Raul would have become the alpha. In society, he's just a monster. He indulged regression, both social and technological. At the culmination of this tale, however, perhaps there was one moment, above all else, in which Raul told us the truth about what really happened, plain and simple. After spending the better part of a day in custody, he called his father, who asked him where he was and what happened. Raul tells him he's in jail because he got in a fight with Mark. He says Mark went for the knife, and he responded in kind, but he was the one who ended up with it. He makes it sound as though he was defending himself. He wants the police to hear him say that. But it's a big mistake. Because what it does is confirm, 15 hours after he stopped drinking, that he realizes, even now while sober, that he was the true assailant. They have the confession from when he's drunk. And by the end of his changing stories, he not only crosses the entire spectrum of potential culpability and ignorance in his claims, but now also suggests the act of stabbing was self-defense. What he didn't realize is that all the cops needed to do was put the knife in his hand instead of Taylor's. This was always considered a murder by the detectives. As soon as Raul claimed self-defense, the reality is that he confessed to murder. As for Taylor Gould's culpability, the lead detective stated, quote, "I feel comfortable that she wasn't held criminally responsible in the murder. Miss Gould could have set up an environment that caused Mr. Gupta to become upset. I also still do believe that she was possibly involved in a relationship with the victim behind Mr. Gupta's back," end quote. And there you have it. That could very well be the case. Whether there was something going on or not, it was apparent to all involved why this transpired. I think Mark understood why this happened, as did Raul Gupta and Taylor Gould. And here's more from the detective regarding Taylor's potential involvement. Quote, "The fact that she wasn't charged with anything doesn't mean that I personally don't believe that she has some culpability in what happened. I just believe that her culpability doesn't rise to a level of criminal nature. But I think it is a hard memory for her to live with for the rest of her life." End quote. That sounds like the truth to me. And I think Taylor's punishment will be that every day, for the rest of her life, whether she's working in the office, gardening outside, doing laundry, playing with her kids, or anything else, on occasion, without notice, even when she's in mid-smile, this event will hit her full force. She'll remember. It will follow her. Everywhere. But as it does, she will walk free. And we can't say the same for Mark Wall or Raul Gupta. So what does she do? She returned to school to get an MBA, but suspicion still clouds Taylor. From the detective, quote, "Miss Gould has something she has to carry for the rest of her life," end quote. From Mark Waugh's father, quote, "His death is a tragedy that we must carry for the rest of our lives," end quote. From Raoul's sister, regarding the heavy burden he has to carry in going from being a promising young student to a lifer in prison for murder, quote, "Raoul and us, you know, we're determined to make the best of this, however that might be. I don't think we have a choice," end quote. And I think that's what resonates most with me about the murder at 1601. This burden we carry, the human condition, the life beneath the surface, where we're trapped, jealous, envious, tired of competing, but thirsting for it even more with each day, like vampires, travelers, nomads, with no destination but desire, a false hope, a wasteland of exhausting emotion, where we're shackled and in tears, screaming, but in silence, and the guards never come. No one visits. We just look through the bars, at the past, at that thing that happened so long ago, the one that changed us forever. It follows you everywhere, to the basement, to the parking garage. You can even see it reflected in other people's eyes. It's scratching, clawing, eating, gnawing at your brain. But we claim, Your Honor, this man is definitely not insane. But he is. He sings and hears things like footsteps and forgets. There's no one behind him, but we remind him. We're coming. We're lurking. We're waiting and generating the wicked smiles of crocodiles with sharp teeth, salivating, praying, staying here to feed this need to know, to hunt, to kill, to grow into a monster, a demon. I wish he'd stop screaming. My name. What is it? I'm complicit? Oh no. Let go. Get off me. Why is that bong next to my coffee? I killed him? Stop lying. I'll blame you for trying. Where am I? What happened to my life when this knife in my hand took this man? He's young. He's bright. You've stolen his light, his future. Stab wounds without sutures. It's all gone. But I guess you think you won. So now the world is much darker. Reality's darker. It says something, mister. Perhaps in a whisper. So let's ask your sister, because I don't have the right kind of words for three lovebirds perched above dry turds. Mark just wanted to be heard, but you couldn't relate to his passion for debate because of your drunk state and being irate at this newfangled love triangle in which he wrangled your girl and shattered your world. Or so goes the story. I can't even look at this shit. Bro, this is gory. I didn't do this. I didn't kill my friend. But the lesson in the end is that we all try to pretend, and for being liars behind our eyes in disguise. Tragedy is our surprise. A nightmare, a foggy glare, in a window to nowhere. But the past and regret is beset by a threat of eternal prison, and the evil that's risen from my soul to my heart, expanded, stretched, and finally ripped apart, taken away on a metal cart, and right back to the start, to an impossible hospital, abandoned, alone, where they gave me one call on the phone. Dad, it's me. I stabbed Mark. Taylor's free. But I'm still here, hoping, moping, dreaming of eloping, yet waiting, as my parents hire someone to do the debating. Person like Mark, someone who reasons, not a guy like me. Winter is my only season. It's cold in my heart, but I'm in here now. I'll have a fresh start. I'll make the best of this place, inside of these walls, until mortality calls. I wonder what it would have been if I didn't sin. I gave it my all before the fall, before I died on the inside, when I was on a ride to the clouds, to my dreams, to a place where nothing is as it seems. But I'm here now. I'm grounded and guilty. A concrete box is what pride built me. Instead of tomorrow, all I have is this cell. Looking back on it now, all I can say is, oh well. But it hurts, you know, to lose that one chance at your dreams. I took that from Mark. At least that's how it seems. But his demise is contrived. It all thrives on lies. I didn't do it, not me. I'll never be free. But I have this burden. My conscience, it streams and wants this night to never end. When I caught my girl and stabbed my friend.
Or did I? I didn't. I don't need to be forgiven. I need to be driven. I need to go back, to get things on track, to reverse what transpired, and tell the lawyer Dad hired that everything's good. I just think that we should shift all this blame and try to defame Taylor Gould. I think they'll be fooled. I think we'll get lucky. I know I confessed, but here's all the rest. I'm really so sorry, but only for what happened to me. So my lack of empathy, you see, was seen by a jury. It caused them great fury and a desire to lure me right into jail and then on to prison. Pieces far off, but ahead in my visions. It's all been surreal to feel. I can't tell what is and what isn't, but the truth is a colorless prism of perspective elected to allow us denial and a reason to smile as we go on trial for our lives, our innocence, and if we win at this, we're free. But I can't, you see? It's all over for me. So let it be. Go away. Here I must stay, behind bars made of steel, with men who don't feel, and food I can't eat. 25 years in this dump, not a damn thing to reap. No way to sow, or just go, except death, your last breath, suicide, the old bedsheet ride, a noose, make sure it's not loose, no pun intended, a life that is ended, not even a note, no reason why, ascend to the sky, just float up to heaven, the old 777. Okay, maybe hell, I'm sure time will tell, but until then, my friends, the lesson to send is that premature ends tend to bend and warp your mind in a way you just can't escape, so take care when you're there in the moment of despair, life will never be fair, so I guess what I need to say is stop, take a breath, and just walk away, fight another day, don't die on that hill, find it in your heart, I know that you will, but if you're feeling that anger, it's haunting you still, build something from love that rises above. Because life is a cage, but this advice it is sage. So make a place in your heart where you'll never feel rage. Start a new chapter, write a fresh page. There are millions of ways to take a road that is paved, smooth and clear, somewhere far away from here, where the sky is lit with the sun, where you are the one. Give us your truth, your light, your strength, your might, your wit, your ways, in a particular haze until the end of days, when the light's rays have graced your face the last time, leaving in haste with bad taste that's bitter like lime. But just say to yourself, offer the intellectual wealth of reading the signs and say this life isn't mine. It's borrowed and returned, but in between a lesson is learned. So try to find meaning. Make sure that you're leaning to kindness and caring and always preparing for that day to come when you'll be the one who's sitting in silence, a victim of violence. So instead, let's try this. Just say that you're sorry, like rocks in a quarry. You'll start filling that hole in your soul and building to the sky. What else could you want but answers to why? We're here in fear and left to steer the ship into space, the whole human race, our collective face, riddled with tears, counting down the seconds, days, and also the years to see what is left and add to the heft, the burden. I can't get a word in because my thoughts are bright and bold, made into stories that are sold for money. And I'll tell you, honey, it's sort of funny. I just keep running but never seem to arrive and move like I'm getting chased by beeves or my hive. It's how we thrive. It's how we learn. But if we don't change, we'll burn? That shit is scary. Seriously, I'm wary of what's next because the text they give us is only religious. I want science, not faith, but I guess we must wait to see with our eyes, to unveil the surprise, the mystery of our history unraveled in time. But for now, we look up and think, this world.